In the name of God, most gracious, most compassionate. Good evening. Thank you very much for coming here tonight, and I know that this is a very special day for people in the Bay Area and Sacramento, and hopefully your favorite team is going to win tonight. Last time I was here, my talk was about Rumi's teachings on the path to inner perfection. I talked about the steps necessary to achieve a more perfect soul according to Rumi. Tonight's presentation deals with Rumi's teachings on some of the pitfalls, some of the dangers in soul development, what we should avoid. So tonight's presentation and the one I had last time here actually complement each other. Similar to last time, I will share with you some stories from Rumi's masterpiece, Mathnavi, and provide some commentary as well so you can more easily follow his ideas. At the outset, let me raise a point about Rumi's background. He is a shining star and a master in human spirituality. One reason for his popularity all over the world is that his teachings are universal. Irrespective of the faith you have, irrespective of the religion or the school of thought that you follow, if you have an interest in spirituality, definitely he has a lot to offer to you. But in my opinion, in order to understand him better, in order to have a better appreciation of what he has to offer, it is very important for us to have a bit of insight into his background. As probably know, he grew out of the spiritual tradition of Abrahamic faiths, and more specifically, in the religion of Islam. It was within Islam's mystical tradition that he managed to create some universal concepts about human life and spirituality. So let me repeat, it's not that his teachings are only appropriate and or meaningful to Muslims. Anybody with any kind of interest in spirituality will benefit from him just because his concepts and his wisdom are so universal, applicable to any faiths in general. His ideas about the pitfall in soul development also originated in the Abrahamic tradition. It's probably instructive to begin my talk with a little bit of what Islam's sacred book, the Quran, has to say about soul itself. Because I'm going to talk about soul tonight, and without knowing what soul is really according to Rumi, we're not going to be able to get much out of his teachings. Again, his ideas about the pitfalls in soul development grew out of the Abrahamic tradition, Islam being just one of them. In other words, the same ideas hold true in Judaism and Christianity as well. The Quran talks about the soul or nafs, and perhaps in chapter 91 of the Quran, verses 7 through 10, we find the most instructive teachings of this sacred book about human soul or nafs in Arabic. وَنَفْسٍ وَمَا سَوَّاهَا فَأَلْهَمَهَا فُجُورَهَا وَتَغْوَاهَا قَدْ أَفْلَحَ مَنْ زَكَّاهَا وَقَدْ خَابَ مَنْ دَسَّاهَا. By the soul and how God formed it and inspired it its own rebellion and piety. The one who purifies it succeeds, and the one who corrupts it fails. In other words, God created the human soul with two capabilities, two sheer potentials. Let me, by the way, make a clarification here. We ordinarily talk about the dark side of the soul and the good side of the soul, right? Rumi actually doesn't talk about the two-sided nature of our soul, because when you talk about side, it implies fixture, something that is fixed permanently. But here, the Quran, and by extension Rumi, talk about pure potential, two possibilities, right? There are two possibilities to the human soul. In Arabic, fujur, which means evil, and taqwa, which means benevolence. This means that the human soul can equally gravitate towards darkness as well as light. The human soul can equally gravitate towards evil as well as benevolence. And the sheer fact that our soul can go in either direction, it means that we can develop and improve our soul. Just because the fact that both paths are open to the human soul. And that's why the verse said that the soul can be both purified as well as corrupted. For the younger folks in the audience, think of your soul as a rewritable CD. You write content on that, but at any point in time, you can wipe out the content and rewrite on it. So nothing is really fixed forever. Here I want to share with you a very important point, which unfortunately I don't have a lot of time to elaborate, and that would be the subject for another discussion. Sufis have a theory about soul development. They believe that there are seven stages to soul development. So if you want to go from build your soul from ground up, there are seven different stations or seven different stages in which your soul is going to move through. I personally like the metaphor of a ladder, which I call the perfection ladder. Think of a ladder that has seven steps, right? At any given point in our lives, our soul is stepping on one of these seven steps. What's more, on each step, the soul will have certain attributes. The soul is going to have certain features and characteristics. The lowest step on this perfection ladder is what the Quran calls nafsul ammara, the carnal soul. And the highest step on this ladder is called nafs safiyyah, which means the pure soul. Carnal soul is the rock bottom. You cannot get any lower than that. And the highest step on this ladder is a pure soul. There are five more steps, you know, in the middle, but again, that's not the subject of tonight's discussion. Suffice it to say that soul development is essentially all about ego management. That's what it is. How are we going to control and manage this thing we all have, which is called the ego? The carnal soul is at a stage which is characterized by unbridled selfishness, a selfishness that absolutely finds no boundaries. At this step, the human personality, the human character, will be absolutely flawed. The person is going to have a lot of character flaws. Things like arrogance, jealousy, vindictiveness, hatred, trickery, deceit. These are all character flaws, or what philosophers would probably prefer to call them moral deficiencies. I personally like character flaws better. Or what probably Rumi would prefer to call it, the crooked character. Right? And having a straight character is crooked. And I'm going to talk about the problem with crookedness in a few minutes. So, the smaller the ego gets, it means that the soul is moving up. The smaller the ego gets, there will be more room for God's presence in our soul. So the bigger the ego is, there is going to be much less room for God to show himself. The highest stage of the soul, which is the pure soul, is where all the remnants of egotism are gone. There is no trace of egotism as well. In the mystic traditions all over the world, in Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, they all believe that there is this state available to all of us, where the soul is going to be absolutely pure. In the Islamic Sufi tradition or mysticism, this stage is called fana, or annihilation. Buddhists will call it self-realization, exactly the same thing. So even though probably a Muslim, a Jew, a Christian coming from the Abrahamic tradition will start on this path to soul purification, and a Buddhist or a Hindu is going to start from an alternative path, ultimately they both end up in exactly the same place, where the soul is nothing but a reflection of its maker or God. Right, so it's a point where the soul is united with its original source. Now, with this brief introduction on the soul, let me share with you some of the dangers, some of the pitfalls that our soul faces in its upward journey towards perfection. So what are some of the pitfalls and the dangers? I'm going to have probably enough time to talk about five of the major pitfalls according to Rumi. The first pitfall in soul development, negligence. Negligence. Or in Farsi or Arabic, we're going to call it ghaflat. Negligence. You see, we mortals all live simultaneously two different lives. Right now, in this room, each one of us is living two separate lives. We have an external life as a member of the broader society. We participate, for example, in the workforce. We exchange goods and services with others. We raise a family. This is the external aspect of life. But at the same time, we all have an inner life, an internal life, that inner private space that is not accessible to anybody. And what we call happiness actually takes shape in this private space. We experience happiness in this inner space. This is very critical for our discussion tonight. I submit to you that in our modern materialistic world, a vast number of us either do not pay enough attention to the inner life, or what's worse, we are completely oblivious to its existence. And for this reason, all of our external accomplishments do not translate into a happy state internally. That's the problem. Rumi illustrates this futility in a story in his masterpiece, Mathnavi. By the way, for in each of these pitfalls, I'm going to share with you a story from Mathnavi, so probably it's easier for you to follow his thinking. Once upon a time, there was a wheat grower in a village. He would spend countless hours tilting his land, seeding plants, and taking care of his farm. Despite of all of his efforts, and despite all of his work, he would harvest his wheat and put it in his barn only for the wheat harvest to become lunch for rats. So he would spend all his energy working, having tangible accomplishments, for all those accomplishments to go to waste. This is Rumi. I'm going to first recite the poetry in original language, Farsi, and then I'm going to give you the translation in English. ما در این انبار گندم می کنیم، گندم جمع آمده گم می کنیم. می نیندیشیم آخر ما به هوش، کین خلل در گندم است از مکر موش. موش تا در انبار ما حفره زده است، وزفنش انبار ما ویران شده است. اول ای جان دفع شر موش کن وانگهان در جمع گندم کوش کن. We are putting wheat in this barn and then we are losing the wheat that has been garnered. Why after all don't we consider with intelligent mind that this damage to the wheat arises from the deceitfulness of the mouse? Since the mouse has made a hole in our barn has been ravaged by its guile. O soul, in the first place, avert the mischief of the mouse, and then show zeal in garnering the wheat. In other words, do not put the carriage before the horse, and that's exactly what we do day in and day out. The smart thing, according to Rumi, is first to plug all the holes on the wall of the barn and then stockpile your good harvest so that your harvest is not going to be meal for somebody who has not done any work for it. The moral of the story is this: when the enemy is in sight, we cannot prosper. See, that's the moral of the story. When the enemy is inside us, we cannot prosper. The enemy can devastate all that we have garnered just because we are oblivious to his existence right inside us. This is our predicament in life. Sometimes it seems that all our hard work, all our professional success does not translate into successful living. Do not confuse professional success with successful living. A great many of us in modern world are extremely successful at work, but we are not actually very successful in living. Just by sheer fact that when you look at our lives, our homes are broken. We are full of rage. We are full of despair and depression. So what is the use for all that accomplishments, professional accomplishments that we have? That's what Rumi is telling us about this pitfall in soul development. So we are not happy, we are not content, we are not at peace. Why? Because we tend to neglect our soul altogether, where it matters the most. That's where we experience happiness. So when we ignore and neglect the soul, we actually ignore where happiness is going to take roots and take shape. And obviously, the soul has its own requirements. That's the critical thing. Just like, you know, to be fit physically, to be healthy physically, our body has certain requirements, certain nourishments have to come into our body, right? The soul has its own requirements as well. The soul needs to be nourished. The soul needs to be taken care of. It is not enough for us to develop our talents, to develop our professional skills, to develop our interpersonal skills. These are all important, but they need to be complemented with soul development to be happy. So, pitfall number one, neglecting soul development as an important project in our daily life. That's pitfall number one. The second pitfall, which is really, really important, that one has to do with projecting our soul's problems onto the outside world. A good many of us have problems inside, and we tend to project our problems into the outside world. In other words, we see all sorts of issues and problems with other people and the world, when in fact the problem is right here. It's inside us. Okay, so let me share with you what Rumi has to say. Again, he's got a fascinating story in Mathnavi that vividly illustrates this pitfall. As you probably know, the Islamic calendar is lunar-based. In other words, as soon as the new moon is visible to the naked eye in the sky, that signals the arrival of the next calendar month. Rumi says that 1 year during the rule of the second caliph, Omar, Muslims wanted to celebrate the end of the month of fasting or Ramadan. So first they need to ascertain that the new moon was visible in the sky. So the Caliph Omar and a bunch of his companions went to the nearby mountain to find the moon. One of the men shouted very happily, "Look, Omar, there's the moon." Omar said, "Where is the moon?" He said, "Just look, over there." So he pointed to a corner of the sky and asked Omar to look at that corner and see the moon. Omar was really, really trying hard to find the moon. He couldn't see it. But when he looked more closely, he saw that a strand of hair was hanging in front of the man's eye. So Omar asked the man to wet his hand and rub it on his eyebrow. چون که او تر کرد ابرو مه ندید. گفت ای شه نیست مه شد ناپدید. گفت آری موی ابرو شد کمان. سوی تو افگند تیری از گمان. When he wetted his eyebrow, he didn't see the moon. O king, he said, there is no moon. It has disappeared. Yes, said Omar. The hair of your eyebrow had become curved like a bow and shot at you an arrow of opinion. Now Rumi draws an important conclusion from this story. چون یکی موی چت شد او را راه زد تا به دعوی لاف دید ماه زد موی کج چون پرده گردون بود چون همه اجزاد کج شد چون بود. When one hair became crooked, it hindered him from seeing truly, so that making a false claim, he boasted to have seen the moon. Inasmuch as a crooked hair veils the sky, how will it be when all your members are crooked? Isn't that fascinating? Isn't that amazing? One strand of hair can make us see crookedness in the universe. Now Rumi asks, what happens if all your soul and character is crooked and flawed? The moral of the story is this. We all see the world, we all experience the world from a perspective, all of us. You know what the point is? That perspective, in turn, is shaped by the development stage of our soul. Let me repeat one more time. We all experience and appreciate the world, look at the world from a given perspective. The perspective that we choose to have on the world is actually dictated by and shaped by the stage of our soul development. That's why a lot of times when you ask your friend, your companion, your child, your neighbor to have a different perspective on things, and that person can't do it, it's just because that person is stuck in a given stage of soul development, you may be way beyond that. So we got to do something about the stage of our soul development if we want to have a different perspective on life. So, having a crooked soul will make us experience and relate to the outside world in a crooked way. And then we will project our inner problems, we will project our issues to the outside world. Then suddenly we think that there is something wrong with the world out there. There is definitely something wrong with my neighbor, my spouse, my family, when in fact the problem is with our soul. And that's pitfall number two. Let me take a detour and bring in somebody called Satan. Okay, we've all heard about Satan. Satan is actually a very central concept in all Abrahamic faiths. In Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, Satan is a very prominent figure. Rumi also articulates his views on the dangers and the pitfalls of soul development using this concept of Satan. Satan, I submit to you, might sound very arcane to a modern audience, and I understand that. But for Rumi, Satan is actually a metaphor for all the dangers and pitfalls on the path to soul development. So lump all of the dangers, all of the pitfalls, Rumi will brand that as Satan. Now, when we are on the lower steps of the perfection ladder, we tend to view Satan as somebody or something that is outside us. The higher up on this ladder we get, in other words, the more we move away from the carnal soul, the more we realize that Satan is actually right here. That's why Rumi cleverly teaches us the following. نفس و شیطان هر دو یک تن بودند در دو صورت خیش را بنمودند. The carnal soul and the devil both have been one person essentially, but they have manifested themselves in two forms. Like the angel and the intellect, which were really one, but became two forms for the sake of God's wise purposes. In other words, the same holds true for angel. Now, for most of us, angel is somebody or something that is outside us. To somebody like Rumi, angel is really our intellect. So having said that, let me continue. So who is Satan? Who is Satan in Abrahamic tradition? For example, the Quran in this tradition informs us that Satan was jinn. Jinn in Arabic means something that is covered, something that is hidden, something that is invisible to the five senses. Does it mean that that thing doesn't exist? No, it means it does exist, but we cannot sense it. In other words, what this notion of Satan or jinn really mean is that there are invisible forces all around us, at work, not at rest, at work, that we cannot see, yet they have real influence on our thoughts, on our motives, and our behavior. They can move us, they can motivate us, they can shape our ideas and behavior, and yet we cannot perceive them. That's the danger of it. You see, it's if one thing for you, for somebody to come, point a gun at you and rob you, it's another thing for somebody to come rob you without you knowing it. Right? So that's the problem with jinn or with Satan. Well, let me give you a couple of examples in the modern world. What do you think opinion making is all about? Isn't that a primary function of the modern mass media, opinion making? When our politicians want to send us to war, what do they do first? They shape, without us even knowing it, they shape our ideas and opinion for us. Then once they give us the marching order to war, we all rush to war, without knowing that they've done a lot of work before to shape our opinion and plant ideas in our head. What's even worse is with modern sophisticated advertisement. I studied economics and I always had problems with my professors because they thought advertisement was really about informing the consumer of the choices they have. And I used to tell them rubbish. Why? Because I said, you know, when I was like 10 years old, I knew that there was something called Coca-Cola. I don't need to be reminded every 5 minutes that there is something called Coca-Cola and it tastes good. Modern advertisement, it's really all about creating and shaping your taste. Right? They create taste for you. That reminds me of something that the late Steve Jobs once said. He said, we are in the business of creating gadgets for people that they even didn't know they needed. You remember that? That's absolutely astonishing. So in other words, other people are creating even needs for us. Satan was of jinn, and jinn means something covered, hidden, invisible, that has a real influence on your behavior and the way your tastes and your ideas are shaped and formed. Enough of that. So you get the point, right? The Quran also informs us that the primary work of Satan is to distort our perception. See, that's the primary role of Satan, to distort our perception. How? Here's a fascinating thing. By making things appear upside down to us. Chapter 15, verse 39. قال رب بما أغويتني لأزينن لهم في الأرض ولأغوينهم أجمعين. Satan said to God, I will make everything fair seeming to people on earth. I will make everything fair seeming to people on earth, and I will put them all in the wrong. There are two critical words in this verse. The first one was zayyana, which means to adorn, to make a thing appear pleasing, to make something appear very good. What do we call this in modern language? Anybody? When you want to make something appear much better than it is to somebody, what do we call that? Window dressing. Right? That's what it is. Window dressing. To make something more appealing than what it is. We have another term for it, by the way. Sugarcoating. Right? Sugarcoating is to make something that is really bitter sweet in our mouth. That's what the verse is really talking about here. Now, what is the whole purpose behind the sugarcoating? What is the purpose behind window dressing? In Arabic, the verse teaches us iqwa, which means to deceive, to cause to err. That's really the whole purpose behind sugarcoating. So, the primary work of Satan is to make things appear the opposite of what they really are. To make bad look good and make good look bad. That's the primary work of Satan. So then, when we see things wrong, guess what? We're going to make the wrong decision. We're going to make all sorts of wrong choices in life. In a nutshell, the structure of the human world, I'm not talking about the physical world, the world that we create, each one of us, for ourselves, the structure of the human world is such that often things are not the way they appear. Can you appreciate that? Things are not always the way they appear. Now, Rumi builds on this concept magnificently in Mathnavi. For example, he teaches us that all good things are typically covered by a skin which is not very appealing. Gold mines are always deep underground. Treasures are always buried under rubble. Beauties are sometimes hidden under seeming ugliness. The sweet is often inside bitterness as well as sourness. And this is basically the world in which we live. The world that the Holy Quran calls Darul Qarur, a place of deception. That's the structure of the world we all live in. The trouble is that since most of us are superficial, we fail to go beyond the surface. So we will judge by what appears to us on the surface. We never go deeper than that. Because of that, we always go wrong. To discover the true, the real, the sweet, and the beauty, you always have to dig deeper than the skin. Now, we have actually come across pitfall number three. When our soul is on the lower steps of the ladder, or in the early stage of development, it is more prone to Satan's deception. In other words, we are more likely to see things upside down. We are more prone to doing that. We are more prone to be superficial. If you ever come across somebody who is very superficial, that's a good indication that the person is on the lower step of soul development. If that is the case, if somebody is on this lower step of soul development, he or she will miss a great deal of the goodness and the beauty and the sweetness in this life. Why? Because those are all covered in a skin. You have to go deeper than that to see the beauty and the goodness in this world. So that is basically pitfall number three. Pitfall number four. This is another interesting one, and it should be very fascinating to the religious people, by the way. Falling for glamorous appearances. Falling for glamorous appearances. And by the way, here I don't mean physical appearance or, you know, facial glamour. That's not what I mean by that. I mean committing evil under the guise of an honorable model. Rumi tells a story in Mathnavi to illustrate. There was a Sufi once who had taken part in a lot of campaigns against enemies of Muslims or the disbelievers. He always fought with his breast bare in the hope that he would become a martyr. When things settled down and the enemies were defeated, he retreated to a life of solitude and mortification, or in Farsi we call it Riyazat Kashi. So he didn't have much interest in public affairs. One day he suddenly heard the drums of holy warriors in the streets, and then came a voice from the inside, the voice of his soul. خیز هنگام قضا آمد برو خیش را در قصد کردن کن گرو. The soul said to him, arise, it's time to fight. Go, devote yourself to fighting in the holy war. As the mystic was ready to go to holy war, he paused for a minute to inspect the call, to evaluate and assess this call. He said to his soul, گفتم ای نفس خبیث بی وفا از کجا میل قضا تو از کجا. O wicked perfidious soul, what have you to do with the desire to fight? In other words, suddenly it dawned on him that death is very dreadful. It's not a good thing. Typically, the soul would come up with all sorts of excuses for us not to go to war. Then he said, why is that all of a sudden my soul is tempting me to go to holy war? There's got to be something wrong here. So the mystic really pressed his soul very hard to reveal its true intention for inspiring for him to go to holy war. And check this out. So the soul responded, در غذا بجهم به یک زخم از بدن خلق بیند مردی و ایثار من. In war, I should escape from the body at one stroke, and the people would see my manly valor and self-sacrifice. In other words, the whole idea behind going to war was not really to do something honorable. It wasn't to do something for God. It was all about fame and glory. This should be very eye-opening to us. See, a lot of times we go and beat on people in the name of God. We go and kill people to make God happy. And we never stop and think, is it really the reason that we want to go do something to make God happy? Or is it just because of the carnal soul that likes fame, that likes glory? So basically, the soul's motive here was not something noble. Rumi's message for us is the following. Be very vigilant. Scrutinize your most honorable motives and actions. That's why I specifically said religious people should be very mindful of this pitfall. Right? We scrutinize all the good things that you do. Why am I really doing this thing that is very good? Why am I doing it? Is it really to help somebody else or to make a name for myself? For somebody on the path to soul development, this is absolutely critical. Unfortunately, often we have hidden agenda that is buried deep in our subconscious and even unconscious mind. We need to dig it up. What is the reason? So this is pitfall number 4. Since we don't have that much time, I'm going to go through the 5th pitfall fairly quickly and close the book on tonight's presentation. Pitfall number 5. Underestimating our immense power for deception. Does it sound familiar? Of all the powers that we have, one of the greatest powers is to deceive. To deceive first ourselves and then to deceive others. We have an amazing capacity for that. You see, you will never lie to someone unless you have already lied to yourself. People who lie, first they have lied to themselves so much that they are now very comfortable. And it is out of that comfort that now they can go out and tell lies to others. So, Rumi's teaching for us is the following. Be very mindful of this amazing and self-destructing capacity that you have, the capacity to deceive. And that's where Satan comes into the picture one more time. There is a story in book 2 of Mathnavi titled Iblis and Muawiyah, where Rumi elaborates on this pitfall. This is one of the most fascinating stories in Mathnavi. It's a long one as well, and unfortunately we don't have enough time, so I'm going to choose a few passages from this his poetic work and share it with you with some commentary. Iblis is another name for Satan in the Quran, right? So Iblis is actually Satan. Muawiyah is a controversial figure in Islam. She is really despised Muawiyah, but the Sunni Muslims respect him for their own reason. He also was the first caliph in the Umayyad dynasty. This is a fictional story with absolutely no basis in history. Okay, so it's a fictional story and the work of Rumi's creative imagination. This story is really about a dialogue between Satan and this person called Muawiyah. In this story, Muawiyah is the symbol of human intellect or reason. And Satan is the symbol of the deceitful soul, the undeveloped soul, the soul on the lower steps of the perfection ladder that tends to deceive us left and right. So this is really a dialogue between intellect and the carnal soul. Rumi in this story tries to show that Satan, or the carnal soul, is indeed very deceitful. It never stops tempting. It never stops erecting barriers, roadblocks in our spiritual life. Rumi's main point in this story is the following. So first I'm going to give you the prize and then the actual story. And so, because I want you to pay attention to what he's trying to say in this story. The main point of this story is that Satan, or untamed and undeveloped soul, calls on us to do something seemingly good, something seemingly honorable, only to detract us from our spiritual goals. It seems right to do X, so we do it, not knowing that Satan is actually taking us on a detour, on the scenic route, so to speak. And soon we're going to forget all about the goal that we had. It's a trick. So you have to be very mindful of these tricks. A lot of times, unfortunately, we go after unimportant things in life thinking that they are the most important things because we've been tricked. That's what Rumi is trying to teach us. Never take your eyes off of the goalpost and the finish line. That's where you want to go. Rumi is really great in this story. And for those of you who are into theology, by the way, I encourage you to read the entire story in Book 2 of Masnavi. It's really fascinating. Here is the story. Rumi says that one day, Muawiyah, the caliph, was sleeping in his palace. He was suddenly awakened by a man who entered the room and hid behind the curtain. Muawiyah said, "Who are you?" The man said, "I am Iblis, or Satan, the damned." Muawiyah said, "Why did you wake me up?" Iblis, or Satan, said, "The time for prayer is all but come to an end. You must run quickly to the mosque." Just think about it. Satan, who is supposed to detract us from praying to God, is asking Muawiyah, "Hey, wake up, it's time to go to mosque to pray." Muawiyah replied, "No way, Jose, it can't be. You're Satan. You're supposed to be devious. You are supposed to be putting roadblocks on my path to God. You're supposed to be making me forgetful of praying to God. Now you're actually waking me up to go to mosque and pray behind the Prophet Muhammad? That can't be the case." Now, in this part of the story, Satan attempts to convince Muawiyah that he's actually very truthful. And he really is serious that he wanted to wake him up to go to pray in mosque behind the Prophet Muhammad. Then Satan actually goes over his resume. He talks about his credentials as an ex-angel of God. Muawiyah doesn't really budge. He makes counter-arguments by pointing to all the good people, to all the decent people that have been victimized by Satan's trickery and deceit. Muawiyah talks about Sodom and Gomorrah, the people of Noah, the pharaohs that were all misled by Satan and were cast into torment. In this part of the story now, Satan provides very profound responses to Muawiyah's allegations. So pay attention to what Satan is saying to Muawiyah. Goft Iblisash gushayin ughdeha man mihakkam qalb ra wa naqd ra. Satan said to him, "Unravel this knot and apprehend the matter. I am the touchstone for the false coin and the true." Satan says, "Listen, it is not fair for you humans to constantly blame me for your problems. It's not fair for you guys to blame me for your faults. I'm just a scale. What is a scale good for? To weigh objects, right?" Satan says, "All I do, I provide a mechanism for you humans to weigh yourself. I never make you heavier or lighter. I just show you your true and real weight. I am basically a touchstone. What is a touchstone good for? A touchstone is good for testing and revealing the qualities of something or a person. امتحان شیر و کلبم کرد حق امتحان نقد و قلبم کرد حق. Satan said, God made me the test of lion and dog. God has made me the test of genuine coin and counterfeit. Satan said, to test whether an animal is a dog or a lion, all you have to do is throw a piece of bone at the animal. If the animal went for it, guess what? The animal is a dog. So then Satan says, that's exactly my job. I throw a bone at you people and reveal who you truly are. Are you a dog or are you a lion? That's all I do. I'm a touchstone. My job is to separate the genuine coin from a counterfeit. If a coin is counterfeit, why do you guys blame me for it? All I'm telling you that this is a counterfeit. Why do you blame me for it? I didn't make the coin counterfeit. You did. You brought your coin to me and I'm telling you it's a counterfeit. And then Satan throws the punchline. نیک را چون بد کنم یزدان نیم دائیم من خالق ایشان نیم. How should I make the good man bad? How should I make the good man bad? I am not God. I am only a promoter. I am not their creator. Satan said, I am not God. I'm not God the creator. I cannot make people good or bad. I only reveal their goodness or their badness. Because it's only God who can create good or bad. I cannot force people to do anything against their will. I can't do that. All I can do is make a call. I cannot force you to respond. I cannot force you to embrace my call. I'm just a promoter. See, this is very instructive for us. If we think about it, Satan is right. He doesn't have any power over us. That's what Rumi is trying to say. God did not give this kind of power to Satan to force people to do something against their own will. We want to be deceived because it feels good. And then we blame Satan for it. خوب را من زشت سازم رد نعم زشت را و خوب را آینم. How should I make fair foul? I am not the Lord. I am only a mirror. I am only a mirror for the foul and the fair. In other words, Satan says, I'm just a mirror. I sit in front of you and show you who you truly are. That's all I'm doing. That's what God made me for. God just made me to be a mirror so that you humans can come and look at me and look it into this mirror and realize whether you are fake or real. I only show the true essence of people. So if you look ugly, why do you guys want to destroy the mirror? Why do you want to break the mirror? You look ugly. What's wrong with the mirror? The mirror is not at fault. Why do you want to break it? So here Satan claims that as a mirror, he always tells the truth. And I would say amen. Satan always tells the truth in a sense. He always tells the truth, but people who are ugly inside blame him for their ugliness. That's the moral of the story. Anyhow, Moab is still obviously not convinced. He represents intellect. He says, no way, I don't accept that. I understand your points. There are good arguments. I can see that. But I am still not convinced that you woke me up to go to mosque and pray. There's got to be something behind that. He tells Satan, you're just wasting your time. I am not going to be deceived by your arguments. Now, this dialogue, this back and forth argumentation continues, and to make a long story, at the end, Satan realizes that Moabiah is resisting very hard, so he stops his deception and unveils his true intention for waking him up to go to mosque and pray behind Prophet Muhammad. And here is the real reason why Satan woke him up. از بن دندان بگفتش بهر آن کردمت بیدار میدان ای فلان تا رسی اندر جماعت در نماز از پی پیغمبر دولت فراز گر نماز از وقت رفتی مر تو را این جهان تاریک گشتی بی ضیا از غبین و درد رفتی اشک ها از دو چشم تو مثال مشک ها ذوق دارد هر کسی در طاعتی لاجرم نشکبید از وی ساعتی آن غبین و درد بودی صد نماز کو نماز و کو فروغ آن نیاز. With bitterest pangs Iblis said, O such and such, know that I awakened you for the purpose that you might join the congregation of Muslims in praying after the Prophet of high estate. If the time of prayers had passed, the world would have become dark to you and without a gleam of light. And then, from disappointment and grief, tears would have flowed from your two eyes in the fashion of water from water skins. Because everyone has delight in some act of devotion. Everybody has delight in some act of devotion and consequently cannot bear to miss it even for a short while. And here is the moral of the story. That disappointment and grief would have been as 100 prayers. That disappointment and grief would have been as 100 prayers. What is ritual prayer is comparison with the spiritual glow of humble supplication. So let me explain to you what Rumi is trying to say here. Satan said to Moabiah, I woke you up to join the morning prayer, otherwise you would have sighed. You would have had such a heartbreak, such a deep sorrow at missing the prayers behind the Prophet Muhammad. And that feeling of sigh, that lament, would have been really unbearable for you. The fact that you missed the prayer would have been unbearable to you. It would be like a fire that would have burnt the wall of separation, the veil of separation between you and God. And I did not want to afford you the opportunity to burn that veil between you and God. So I wanted you to go to do your mechanical ritualistic prayer and be stuck in it. In other words, Satan wanted to detract Moabiah from the real spiritual goal of getting closer to God. That's why he said, that sigh that you would have had, that feeling of sorrow, was far more valuable than 100 prayers itself. That is the trick that Satan or the carnal soul can have on us. Rumi here is also arguing that in religious life, Satan's deceit does not always lead to abandoning prayers and rituals. Right? Sometimes, in contrast, Satan really wants us to be stuck in the formalities of religion. So we get stuck in it. What do we call this? Religious formalism. When we glorify the formalities, when we glorify the mechanical and the ritualistic dimension of the prayers. Rumi tells us that that is the work of Satan or your carnal soul. Sometimes Satan makes us preoccupied with these formalities and we mistakenly think that all is well, all is just dandy because we are praying on time and do it exactly as the book says. So that's really the problem. Whereas what really counts the most is what lies beyond the formalities. So pitfall number 5 is understanding our power to deceive. Sometimes we deceive ourselves by praying a lot to God. Are you with me? Why? I'm not saying that don't pray to God. I'm saying be mindful of what you are praying for. Praying by itself is not really valuable. It's not. Sometimes actually it feeds the ego. See, sometimes you see a lot of religious people that boast that, you know what, I make Hajj every year. I pray 100 times a day. They boast. They think it's just, you know, another feather in their hat. Remember, the whole point in soul development is to make the ego smaller. When we boast, even boasting about the fact that we pray a lot, that means that the carnal soul still is very prominent and very big in our life. Be very mindful of that. So let me close with a final word. Our spiritual journey is fraught with dangers. It is not enough to have an interest in soul development. We also need to be aware of the pitfalls. Just as it's not enough in the business world to go and open a business, you have to know who your competitors are. Otherwise, you're not going to succeed. This is exactly true in the spiritual world as well. It's not good enough just to have an interest in spirituality and soul development. We must know the pitfalls and the dangers as well. The undeveloped soul can trick us to doing things that have nothing to do with our salvation and our happiness. It will take us to all sorts of places. So we have no time, no energy left to go where we should go, to meet our Creator, to meet the source we all came from, and that is God. I hope that this presentation about the pitfalls on the path to soul development, the teachings of Rumi, of some value to you, and inshallah I will come back here and give you some more insight into Rumi's teachings in the future. Thank you very much for your attention, and God bless you all.